Good morning, folks. It's good to be back this morning, and so happy that to be back, and glad that looks like most of the weekend here in the city of New Orleans, things went without a hitch, and that's good to hear as well. I hope you enjoyed your July 4th celebration, the 249th birthday of our country. We entered the 250th birthday year. Will be very exciting with a whole lot of activities and festivities scheduled throughout 2025, 2026, the remainder of 25 and all of 26. So we look forward to that as well. We've got a great show lined up for you today. We'll visit with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust, and we're going to talk about the economic impact of the big, beautiful bill. We're going to get into the granular level of this bill. There's been a lot of information floating back and forth as to what it actually does. A lot of the reporting is now revealing some of the particulars of this bill. Some are understated, some are overstated, some are just flat-out lies. So we'll try and resolve those issues at 12 o'clock with Guy Williams. Ryan Young, senior economist with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, will talk about the June jobs report, what it means, and where we stand at the present time as it relates to unemployment. Dr. Jennifer Avegno joins us at 11, the director of the New Orleans Health Department. There are a number of provisions within the Big Beautiful Bill that talk about Medicaid, Medicare, and other issues as to how health care is delivered in this country. We'll get her appreciation of what programs may be impacted here in the city of New Orleans. At 10:30, Dr. Robert Hogan, professor and department chair of the political science at LSU, will talk about the passing of this bill and what it means politically for Republicans. What is the strategy going to be for Democrats? And we'll talk a little bit about the background of that as we move forward, and the fact that we may have some future budget bills that are going to be dealt by reconciliation as opposed to a budget bill, which kind of changes the requirements and what that ultimately will mean. I wanted to start off this morning, just our thoughts, our prayers, our hearts go out to the family members of the young kids that were lost from Camp Mystic and all of those families of all the victims in the flooding of the Guadalupe River in Kerrville, Texas. Very familiar with Kerrville. Used to hunt right outside of Kerrville. Hunted extensively through the hill country back in the late 70s, early 80s, Round Mountain, Marble Falls, all through that area, west of Austin, east of San Antonio, Johnson City, all through that area. Just absolutely stunning landscape through there, but challenges when you have significant rainfall as it relates to the rivers and the tributaries to those rivers and the impact that it has. And, you know, there's been a lot of finger pointing that's going on here in the last couple of days. I'm not sure that any of this is going to matter much. I always take the same approach that when I look at these things, as I say about our preparation for the hurricane season and the immediate aftermath of the hurricane season. You can't look for others to execute. Either you're going to do it yourself or just simply ain't going to happen. The more that you can take control over, the more that you control, the better off you're going to be. If local government decides that this is going to be a priority, it seems to me you do so. I don't know what they did or what they didn't do. I haven't dug down into it at a granular level. But I know that any time that you're looking for others to execute on your behalf, you're in trouble. And that was my experience over the 40 years that I served in law enforcement and the preparation that I had my organization as the sheriff, as the chief criminal deputy, as the chief financial officer, as to how to finance the measures needed. As you looked at it, used to fight with all kinds of watchdog groups about our fund balance and why we needed so much money, and why it was better for us to have a lot of money in surplus or in fund balance. 6 months operating expenditures was always a target that I was looking for, because of these types of events. Because you got to be able to get things, get them quick, get it fast, get it done. Or the ability to pay overtime, to get people out there looking for the victims. All of these things, and not doing it hoping that the federal government's going to step in and back you up and have a declaration and just go on and on and on from there. You have to control it. These are your people. These are your constituents. First and foremost, you're at the front line. I don't know what they did there. I have no idea. It's not a criticism. It's just an observation based on my experience in dealing, whether it's swift water rescue, whether it's urban search and rescue, flooding, hurricane prep, aftermath, debris removal, all of these things. I think collectively, with all of the issues that Mother Nature has dealt Southeast Louisiana over the years, we've come to the realization, as I said earlier, if you don't control it, it just simply ain't going to happen. So I wasn't surprised, just to pivot real quick, I wasn't surprised to see that the mayor, again, went on the oh, woe is me tour. I guess she has decided that in the last 100 or so days of her administration, as many groups that she can get in front of where she can talk about how poorly she was treated by the constituents and the political dynasties and elite, I guess, over the years of her administration, she's going to take every opportunity and make sure that everybody realizes that it wasn't the inefficiency, the ineffectiveness, or the ineptitude of my administration. It's just that people don't like black women in powerful positions, and therefore they go about, as she puts, a crucifixion by critics of her. And she goes on to say, the panelist, the facilitator, gave some nice comments about the mayor, and it's by saying that tough times don't last, but tough people do. And I guess the mayor seized upon that, according to a Fox 8 article, and says that she said, I would say a call to action is really looking at leadership in a way that is to be continued. So that's growing your own, growing from within, building people up. We're in a climate that wants to tear mayors down, and black ones and black women especially, and have taken our mayors out. And who've been through the trenches, who was faced with, oh, you can't do it, but every turn demonstrating that we are built for this and we're leading our people. So I would say the call to action is to be engaged and involved on a local level and making sure that who you elect truly does represent and reflect the values that have been set, because the people will let you know their values. She goes on to say, you're aligning your administration and your priorities with the values of the community. So when it comes to electing leaders, you have to be intentional about that, because we're doing the work. And then here comes somebody else who may not look like you because you laid it all out, but we have to ensure and support local leadership. I could look at some of my sister mayors that did the job, but they were taken out, and I was one of them. But the fact of the matter is, they didn't take me out, but they tried. I was elected in November 2017 with 60% of the vote. I was reelected in November of 2021 with 65% of the vote. And 3 months later, I was in a recall funded by $1.4 million and was able to move through that because of the people. So what I'm saying is, the call to action is to pay attention. Be engaged, really. Put your vote behind people that have alignment with your values and support them. Because you applaud me for being the first woman mayor in New Orleans. Thank you for that. But it's about the support as you move through. Because I'm telling you, it goes from celebration to crucifixion real fast. And I do agree with the mayor on that. It does. When you're inept, when you're ineffective, when you constantly reveal the inability to get things done, by surrounding your yourself with some folks that were not worthy of the positions that were there, they all rose to the forefront. They all revealed themselves to be ineffective, not able to do the job, an embarrassment to this city. That went on and on and on. We had issues that we could not deal with, would not deal with, decisions that were not made, decisions made that were disastrous. I mean, continuing on to today with, you know, the trust fund, the Wisner Trust Fund, still taking action contrary to the best interests of its taxpaying citizens. No one can figure out why, other than, I guess, she wants to be right. Yeah. Can't pay lifeguards on time, two summers in a row. And the list just goes on and on and on. We know what they are. We've had to live through them. We've been lied to about our capacity on a cash basis moving forward. Now we're choosing that we're not going to pay vendors again in 30, maybe not 60, maybe 90, asking for extensions from the council as it relates to the ordinance to pay vendors on time. That's a scary proposition. And then the other tax recipient bodies that receive tax dollars from the administration, we're now cutting those in half in quarterly payments because we don't have the money. How did we get to this situation? The mayor thinks that that's a crucifixion. If you want to ask these questions about why are we having such a difficult time funding government? Why are we having such a difficult time dealing with blighted housing? Why can we not get traffic signal lights to actually work? Some have been out 6, 7, 8 months. Why are we owing vendors $20, $25 million to repair lights? Why did it take 2 years and a lot of citizen involvement in the French Quarter to get lights up, signs up? Why do we have and continue to have a problem with improving our sidewalks and getting them repaired so you're not tripping and falling on your face? And the whys just continue to mount. Now, if that's a crucifixion, then she's right. It's a crucifixion. We're crucifying her with questions about why things are not getting done. It's plain and simple. It's about the priorities. We talked about this a million times. And I guess that's the way she's going to spend the last 100 or so days of her administration, is the "oh, woe is me" tour, as though the more I say it, maybe the more people will believe it, and I'll be able to redefine my legacy as the mayor of the city of New Orleans. And that's what this is all about. She doesn't give a damn about the impact on you. The fact that you haven't been able to drive to your driveway in your home for 14 months, right? She didn't care that you have to park around the block and that you have this complete total disruption to your life because of poor planning. But that question, I guess, shouldn't be asked, because we're doing something, you know, that maybe we shouldn't be doing, asking silly questions, obvious questions, like, it'd be nice if I could drive to my driveway. I'd like to be able to park in front of my house instead of around the corner for such a long period of time. It would be nice to be able to execute on the dollars that we receive from FEMA as we will celebrate the 20th anniversary on August the 29th. And I think we still have over $1 billion unspent. She doesn't bring any of this up in her comments. There's nothing that she brings up, you know, about Jeffrey Vappy, about that relationship, about, you know, trying to manipulate police investigations, manipulate police promotions, manipulate things for her purposes, a not-for-profit that she had, a manipulation of IT spending, a manipulation of the Wisner Trust, a manipulation of the Sewage and Water Board, and going nowhere. And yet, this woman feels crucified. So it's going to be interesting to see. It's really kind of embarrassing for the city. And for her to say other sister mayors that have been taken out, who, the mayor in Chicago? Is she complaining about that whack-a-mole? What mayor, the mayor in Baltimore? Didn't she have all kind of financial issues and was, I don't recall, I think one of them was indicted? That's a crucifixion? The mayor in San Francisco? That individual that was all over the map? How about the mayor in D.C.? Wouldn't let people congregate at a church, but they could have protests in the streets all day long during the pandemic. Continues to engage in policies that are absolutely crazy, and now is on her best behavior because Donald Trump said he'll take the whole city over and do away with all the silliness that's gone away in order to preserve Washington, D.C. Now we're going to pay attention because we've got everything from a monetary standpoint. People are fed up. It's like Ghost Town USA. Crime running amok there. All of these folks were crucified? Are these the people that she's talking about? Is this what we aspire to here? I mean, it's kind of a joke. You know, and I want to say, it's not that the mayor has not done some good things, because she actually has. But it hasn't been consistent. It hasn't been with that intentionality that she talks about. Intentionality is not a fleeting moment. It's a mindset. It's a construct. It is a strategy about how you go about everything that you're working on, not the things you like. You get them accomplished, and then all the others, there's nothing that is done. That's not intentionality. And she talks about the crucifixion, but it's amazing. In her second term, she got elected with 65% of the vote. So there was obviously a crossover vote from a racial perspective that voted for her. Over and over and over again. And that's okay. That's fine. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be any less critical or observant of what's actually happening day by day by day. It begs of that being there. So it'll be interesting to see how this remains, how many more groups she's going to get in front of and say that America hates black women in leadership positions. And that's what this is all about. And the only reason that she's being crucified is because of her race and because of her gender. That's it. That can be the only logical explanation. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're joined by Dr. Robert Hogan, professor and department chair of political science at LSU. Doc, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you.
So, Doc, the bill passes by reconciliation, very narrow margin, politically, what are the challenges for Republicans moving forward as well as Democrats?
Well, you're right. It passed by the slimmest of margins with this reconciliation. You only needed a majority in each house each chamber of the Congress. So in many ways, this is not a bill that has, and in many of the last minute sort of provisions that were taken in and put out to satisfy different constituencies within the Republican Party means that this is not a bill that has been sold to the American people yet. Many parts of it are very unpopular, as polling seems to indicate. We're in a very different policy process than we normally have in the United States. I mean, normally, in previous many decades, presidents have proposed major policy changes, and they go out to the public and sell it there. They often have many events across the country talking about touting its many positive and salutary effects that it will have on various aspects of society that they want to emphasize. And sometimes they encourage the public to write their member of Congress and tell them, hey, support my legislation. You would often, see presidents, talking to citizens and how it's going to, demonstrating, giving detailed examples of how it's going to bring a benefit to, a family of four living in Iowa or whatever. And then you have a long and deliberate process of talking about the specifics. You would have a discussion about, the effects that it would have, the upside, the downside. And there would be a lot of common ground that people have on the basic data and this, the social science that we can bring to bear on how policy would have a change. Here we have a system that's sort of been turned on its head. And this is not simply the Trump administration. This is something that you see in Democratic administrations. You have these reconciliation packages in which major changes to policies are not vetted in the sense that you get a full deliberation with the public and among the media people that talk about these sort of things. So you have a process that barely passes, and people are sort of waking up and saying, okay, so what does this do? And now you, on the back end, you see the president now trying to sell it to the American people. So you have a really backwards process. And I think there are a lot of surprises in it. And given the major changes it is bringing about, I think it's something that people are going to have a lot of questions about. The biggest of which, of course, is $1 trillion, that is with a T, is going to be reduced in Medicaid spending. And that is a tremendous change that has, given the size of Medicaid in this country, has a ripple effect throughout the healthcare industry. And there are many people in states that have large rural populations worried about the ability of healthcare or to get the same level of healthcare they got in a lot of rural areas. So there are a lot of questions. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but I think you were asking mostly about the politics of this, and I think that this is a backwards way of policymaking if you look at the way we've done it in the past.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, just the messaging all around this, whether it be Democrats, Republicans. I don't know that Republicans have actually gone out, like you said, and done their homework on selling the bill. Obviously, a number of Democrats are saying a lot of different things, one being that people will die as a result of this. And forget to really, I think, put things in context when you talk about Medicaid increases over the last 5 years, 6 years, increasing by 50% as a result of a lot of what was going on with Medicaid expansion, and a lot of that was linked to what was happening in the pandemic. I just find it a little mystifying that people think that we were going to be able to continue and support and sustain that level of funding. This bill cutting $1.3 trillion over a 10-year period of time reduces it by about 1.5% over that 10-year period of time in increases in Social Security. Looking to the states who have shifted basically from a 50-50 share formula that was the accepted relationship for a number of years to where the federal government is now covering in some cases almost 100, but definitely over 90.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that we're talking past one another and we're not recognizing, what's actually happening here. What's really interesting to me is that a lot of the provisions in this bill were actually proposed by Barack Obama back in 2014. You know, the provider tax being reduced to 3.5%, the same thing with work requirements that were being in place because of able-bodied people receiving Medicaid and not working and not trying to get off of the public dole, so to speak, and moving folks off. It's like we have this short memory of where we are on this. And I guess, like you said, everybody's to blame because it's all about the wins and the losses and not really about how we're going to manage debt and how we're going to be able to continue forward.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't disagree with some of what you said. I think that you're right. $1 trillion may only be a 1% cut over 10 years. But you also have to consider, of course, the fact that healthcare costs, unlike the cost of televisions, goes up dramatically. It's higher than inflation for a whole variety of reasons. And so, those costs are, and when you consider that, this is a tremendous cut to Medicaid. And you're right, it is a shifting, right? It's a shifting of responsibilities. States have been attempting through the provider tax to get more out of the federal government than they did in the past. And there have been attempts, you're right, on both sides to change that formula. And, and that's something that probably should be considered. But it also is something that ought to be debated. It ought to be talked about.
And, well, there's no doubt.
The pros and cons need to be considered. And it's like we're not really doing that in a way that is the process to me seems very different than in the past, and partly maybe because Trump has looked at what's happened in the past and you see when presidents have these big initiatives like on health care. It started with health care. It doesn't always work. It's very difficult. George W. Bush wanted to alter the Social Security system, right? Wanted people to have their own savings accounts that they could invest in the stock market. He had 100 or so town hall meetings across the country and talked about it. That went nowhere, in part because you have these entrenched interests in Washington that sort of stop everything. It's very difficult to make any change. And I think what's happened is that presidents have found that, hey, we have to figure out a different way to get things passed. And, this is what Trump is doing. But I do think that there are some big downsides to that, especially if there are hidden costs and negative effects that a lot of people aren't considering.
Yeah, there's no doubt. For me the other day, I was listening to one of the Democrats criticizing, was a local government individual criticizing the bill and saying, unfortunately for us now, we're not going to be able to build the tennis court that we got a federal grant for. And, I've been around a long time. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, well, wait a minute. Why would the federal government be funding a tennis court? And it seems as though we have shifted these obligations from local government to state government to federal government, not wanting to face these issues. Maybe I'm crazy, but I just don't think the federal government should be financing tennis courts. That should be more of a local activity.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
And, well, and with all the big issues that we have, I mean, it just highlights to me a bastardization of setting of priorities at the federal level versus state versus local.
No, I don't. I think a lot of people would agree with that. I mean, I don't know what to say to that other than the fact that, I mean, governments over time, you know, come up with different ways of you know, where you get the money from, and what you do with it. I remember that it used to be that they had this revenue sharing system that came out in the 1970s where the federal government funded a lot of things like tennis courts and a lot of local level projects. Sometimes when, you know, local level governments couldn't afford it, or there are certain states, of course, as we know, that can't afford everything that they need. There are some states that are donor states and some states that are receiver states when we mix all of our money together. So the federal government is funded more by some states than others, and some, especially the blue states, who are often the donor states to some of the red states in terms of taxation, have started, you know, to resent that. We have these debates a lot, but it's like we usually talk about one little sliver of it, and we don't put everything on the table and say, you know, what are we doing here?
Yeah, I get nervous because I wonder, you know, how we are ultimately going to deal with the Social Security issue, right? I mean, the recalculation the other day has now shortened the period of time or the date where we're going to have some decisions to be made. I'm not certain whether the rules are going to allow this a remediation of it or a course correction by reconciliation or not. But one would think that if this thing is going to blow up in 2032, that in 2025 we ought to be having serious conversations about it, right?
Yeah, you would hope some forward thinking on a big issue such as that, and it's one that is really, you know, a lot of people, you know, set their hair on fire about it and worry about it. In other ways, it is an issue that isn't too difficult to solve with some tweaks. It's one of these things where if you make some tweaks early on in advance of the cliff, it's not something that has to be that painful, but it seems to me that Washington is so often run, you know, in a crisis management style where the crisis has to be imminent before policymakers want to get together and actually do something.
From a political perspective, when you look at this process that we've just been through, my thought is that it's really not conducive to improving the relations between Democrats and Republicans in the House and the Senate. Would you agree?
Oh, I would agree completely. This is, again, you would hope that the parties would get together. There would be some bipartisan agreement on some of these items. But this was, I mean, I think that the big thing, the big takeaway for me from this is the tremendous amount of power that Trump has in a way that we have not seen a president have before. I don't think many people in the last few days have pointed to the political acumen of Mike Johnson in terms of getting this through the House, or Mr. Thune in the Senate. What they've been pointing out is that people are very afraid of Donald Trump. They recognize that MAGA is a force to be reckoned with. Trump can direct his voters in a way that will shut down people who are in opposition to him. I mean, you saw that with Senator Tillis in North Carolina. It reminded us all of Jeff Flake out in Arizona. And people who do want to reach across the aisle, the ones that do want to compromise, are pushed aside. And I don't think that's a good recipe for for governing going forward. And I think that we are, you know, we have the presidency, in a lot of people's opinion, I certainly think in the founder's opinion, had far too much power before Donald Trump stepped into office a second time. But he, the presidency has awesome powers now, I think is undeniable. And I don't know that that's something that is beneficiary to the country in the long run.
Yeah, I think more so he diminished the authority of the leaders of the party in both respective houses, right? I mean, when we talk about, that aggressive style of leadership, I mean, Schumer has utilized it, Pelosi utilized it, having to keep the factions together within that party. Mm-hmm. Republicans, for the most part, tried and failed. And it seems to me that President Trump says, well, I can't rely on the leadership of the Republican Party in the houses because they always fragment and implode. So I'll just steamroll them is kind of the way I look at it. And because if I want to get anything accomplished, I'm not going to get it accomplished. Because history tends to repeat itself, right? It's like
that's a concern. I think is that what happens going forward is that you have a president who we've grown accustomed now to a president who behaves in that way, and I think you're going to see the same sort of thing going forward on the Democratic side the next time there's a Democratic president.
Yeah, well, because if they want to get reelected and if they want to leave an imprint on the country, they can't wait around for, the inability of Congress to make a decision in many respects.
Right.
And I guess, for most of those leaders, it's incredibly frustrating. As always, totally enjoy the conversation. Dr. Robert Hogan, professor and department chair of political science at LSU. Thank you so much for joining us and have a great week.
Nice talking to you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. So I got a number of texts, folks not understanding exactly what we were talking about. Got a text here, 15% cut, now 1.5%. It's 15% in the state of Louisiana is what it might work out to be. They're still working on those numbers. But it's just bending the curve, and it's about a 1.5% cut in Medicaid funding over the next 10 years. You will recall, and I've said this before, that in the last 5 years, a 50% increase. In the last 6 years, because of what the Biden administration did, I supported Medicaid expansion because I knew that it was going to help save and help hospitals recover in this state that were down and out during the major portion of the pandemic. But I also knew that we couldn't continue at that level of funding in the future. There's no way, no how. Could not happen. It was consuming too much of the federal dollar out there, and states were shifting too much responsibility to the federal government. Since 2019, Medicaid spending has increased almost 60%. In 6 years, 60%. And what we're finding is a lot of folks are not living up to the terms and conditions that are set forth right now and whether or not they qualify, because the Biden administration relaxed the rules and did not enforce those that were violating the rules. Sound familiar? So we ended up with more people on the Social Security rolls than what the program was designed to be. Again, we don't know the numbers. So one of the things that this bill did was that you have to prove your income not once a year, but twice a year in order to try and get your hands around this situation to see who should be in and who should be out. And if it's a who should be out, you want to get that who should be out sooner so that you can reap the benefits of those savings because they don't qualify. Now, there are a lot of people that are against that. They don't want that to happen. I don't know why, but if you're not entitled to the benefit, why should we give it to you? Does that sound familiar as well? I mean, this theme keeps appearing in so many different ways, and it's impacting you, me, and everyone else. We'll be right back.